This is the Education Gadfly Show.
This pendulum stuff is nutso.
I'm turning into Checker here, Amber.
I know.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my special guest for this week, Paolo De Maria, Ohio's State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Paolo, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Yeah, also joining us from Fordham, Brandon Wright.
Hello.
All right. Well, Paolo, we are so excited to have you on and honored. You know, we now have had just a handful of state superintendents, but we're especially excited given that Ohio is Fordham's home state, Dayton, our hometown. So it's great to have you on. Yeah. Thanks for calling in from Columbus.
Pleasure to be doing it.
Yeah. And, you know, Paolo and I have several things in common, including that we both like to ride our bikes to work when it's not so cold. So we're both about to dust off
the
bikes.
Hopefully this week will be the first time.
Yes, exactly. No more excuses. It's getting warm. There we go.
That's right.
Well, good. Well, we've got lots to talk about on the Ohio education front and how it intersects with other national reform happenings. Let's do that on our Ed Reform Update. All right, Paolo. Well, lots going on. You've got new NAEP scores, as does everybody, of course. You have been working through your ESSA plans, and now you are working on a strategic plan for the Ohio Department of Education. Tell me about that piece. What's your plan for improving Ohio's education system?
Yeah, and I think it actually came out of two things that happened. One was when I was hired as superintendent just about 2 years ago, I felt like Ohio had this need to really become more strategic about its thinking in terms of its policies and practices, how it supports districts, and how it defines, you know, what it's trying to do to sort of rally everybody around the same thing. And then I think that was further reinforced during the ESSA plan development process because, you know, ESSA deals with a certain sort of narrow strand of things, and it felt very unsatisfying to say, well, okay, we're doing these things over here, but we really want to address some other things as well. And so how can we do that? And the strategic plan gave us an opportunity to go down that direction. So to folks who go to our website and download the current draft, you'll see a number of interesting things. Starting with the title, which tries to capture the idea of what we're trying to do. It's called Each Child, Our Future, and it's really about focusing on each and every child and what each child needs, and how do we as a system organize ourselves to make sure we're addressing the needs of each child. And the idea of our future is the fact that these kids are our future. But it's the our part emphasizes that this is partnership. We really need to bring all the various resources to the table, whether it's social service organizations, healthcare organizations, the philanthropic community, the faith-based community, all these folks that have a vested interest in students as well, maybe looking at it through their own lens, and bringing them to the table and reinforcing their commitment to helping every student succeed.
So that's good, Paolo. But, we are the Education Gadfly here, and I can kind of picture Checker reading this, some of this stuff, and rolling his eyes or kind of wanting to put on a Whitney Houston song in the background about children are our future. I mean, of course they are,
Sure.
As dads, and we, of course, yes. But show me the meat. Tell us about some of the major themes. I mean, Paolo.
So one of the key things is that we recognize that students are facing increasing challenging circumstances as they grow up. I mean, you know the data as well as I do about adverse childhood experiences, the kind of trauma that students are facing, the various stressors on their life. And so one of the things we've done is make it clear that in terms of the learning domains that we look to the education system to be involved in, we're expanding those beyond simply the academic, right? So we always think of schools as being, about English and math and social studies and science. And we've got, two domains that capture those foundational skills as well as well-rounded, sort of academic content. But we also lay over on those two learning domains. One is about reasoning and sort of leadership skills. These are the things that we think of as the 21st century skills. Everybody is always saying, well, the business community says they need students who are good at problem solving, design thinking, creativity, data analysis. So we've got those in a domain. And then the social emotional skills, students having a growth mindset, students being able to persevere, having self-awareness, being able to work together in groups. And so I think a lot of people, as we've taken this around the state for stakeholder feedback, feel like calling those out and being deliberate about it. We're not saying that those things haven't been nurtured in students in the past, but being deliberate about it and knowing that we can develop a common language and some common ideas about how do we help students gain those skills, because those are going to be equally as important to their success as they go forward, whether it's in college or in a career path, or whether they want to be an entrepreneur, or even if they're just going to, you know, end up being a part of a family unit.
Yeah. No, and look, of course, I mean, I get that. And I think it is important to talk about well-rounded kids. And we certainly all went overboard in the No Child Left Behind years and being so narrowly focused on reading and math skills. So that, you know, I don't have a problem with that. But I guess what I would want to see or want to know, Paulo, is in a more concrete way, you know, is Ohio committing to improving its outcomes? I mean, you look at some plans from other states, you know, not just ESSA plans, but strategic plans or what you see on their websites. And many of them are very concrete. You know, they say, look, we are not satisfied with our outcomes in terms of student achievement. We are going to narrow achievement gaps. We're going to, you know, we want to be in the top 10 or the top 5 of the country on NAEP. Or they also talk about completion. They say, look, we got to get more kids to and through 4-year degrees, 2-year degrees, 1-year technical credentials. You know, we want to have whatever, 60%, 70% by a certain date, having valuable post-secondary credentials. I don't see that kind of language in here with Ohio. And this is a state which is now one of the only states where the achievement gap on NAEP is widening, you know, where there's basically been no progress in 10 years, like a lot of other states. I just worry that we're sleepwalking. And so where is the sense of urgency that says, hey, okay, all these skills, all the knowledge, all these attributes, yes, but it's to an end, which is to help kids actually be successful in today's economy and to be well-prepared citizens. Right. I mean, can
well,
we get
actually,
more
that's
to
where,
that?
You know, so that's where our goal statement comes from. You know, it was very tempting to go back and pick out goal statements that represented either NAEP scores or ACT scores or all the traditional academic indicators that we've used in the past. But what we want to do is basically say, okay, do our students actually go on to be successful in what they do after high school? So we've identified three things, which is essentially being enrolled and succeeding in a post-high school learning experience, which would include adult career tech. It would include a, you know, 2-year or 4-year college, an apprenticeship program, and what have you. Serving in a military branch is the second key thing. And then the third one is earning a living wage. We, you know, by stating it that way, I think it puts the system more in tune with what are those competencies, you know, and knowledge and skills. Because so many times, and you've seen them as much as I have, Mike, that you have students that do well academically, but then they go off to college and they can't succeed because they can't function in that college setting. And you also see those times when students, you know, are able to succeed in college, even though they haven't, you know, reach, let's just take a, you know, remediation free score on the ACT, because in that college setting, they know how to manage their time. They know how to be good students. They're in a college setting that is providing them the supports they need, and they can be successful in that setting as well. Or they're in an apprenticeship program or something else that has a hands-on element that speaks to their particular passion, their aspirations, and they're going to be successful. So part of our point of view is to tip things away from constantly focusing on these standardized assessments as the measure of success and really looking at success in terms of what students are doing in the real world.
But you still want your NAEP scores to go up, right, Paolo? I mean, let's make
well,
it both
know,
and.
I think that's a debate happening that's going to happen increasingly among state superintendents about, you know, I mean, we see places where we hold them up as having done some great things and their NAEP scores are going down. And I think there are people out there wondering whether the persisting focus on NAEP is really the thing that's right by our kids.
For these possible pathways, a big question I think people often have or concern, right, is related to things like tracking. And obviously that's not what you're intending here. But when and how are sort of these pathways determined for individual students?
Well, again, I don't think it's a matter of when and how as much as, because I would argue to be successful in every one of these pathways, you know, you want to help a student reach challenging and rigorous acquisition of knowledge and skills. So we're not shying away from the fact that, you know, we want every student to be good at math, good at English. How they get to be good at math, how they get to be good at English, and the type of English and the type of math, and how they're asked to demonstrate whether they have mastered English and math. That's where I think we're going to be very creative. And you see that come through in our strategies. I mean, I was just yesterday at a major celebration of 300 of the best high school art students. And if you really understand how like the AP art exam is administered, it's all about student demonstration of learning, and because it can't be done as a standardized test. How do we bring those kind of ideas to assessing a student's mastery of the English language, their mastery of mathematical concepts? So, because I think we're seeing over and over again that simply sitting them down at a computer once a year and putting them through a test isn't really the best way to have students demonstrate what they know, what they're capable of, and what they're able to do.
So then how do you essentially hold all of your schools accountable for trying to essentially, right, furthering these four domains, right? Obviously, for right, the academic that's, stuff, you test, but what about the nail on the SEL head. And...
It becomes a, you know, that becomes the challenge, is that are there ways, and it's true both in all four of the domains, right? What does assessment look like that allows students a greater opportunity to demonstrate what they know and are able to do in a way that's still, you know, fair and equitable and serves an accountability purpose, but may have different variations on a theme than what we may be currently used to. And then, you know, to the extent where you get into some of the social emotional factors, you know, how do you want to gauge the progress you make? I think it's harder to imagine actually a formalized assessment structure. But I think there are ways, because I think there are ways today that people are able to ascertain, well, you know, here's a student, how would you rate their ability to work in groups? And, you know, have they mastered that skill set in a way that creates the opportunity for them to succeed in demonstrating it once they leave high school?
All right. Hey, Paolo, thank you so much for your time here today. A lot to chew on. People should check out this plan. You know, it's always fascinating to me to see the ideas floating around nationally, how they end up informing these state plans and then vice versa.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's
there's so much great stuff happening on the national level, whether it's on the social emotional side. Lots of great things happening on performance based assessment models. Lots of things happening on, you know, alternative accountability structures and focusing on connections to careers and the kind of skills that our employer community is saying that they want to see students have. And we're doing a lot of those things in Ohio and are hoping to, you know, further amp up those great activities.
All right, great. Well, thanks for joining us. Hope you will be back. Paolo De Maria, the state superintendent of public instruction in the great state of Ohio. Come back soon.
Keep up the great work you guys are doing. Take care.
All right, thanks. And now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show, Amber.
Thank you, Mike.
So, you know, that interview we just did with Paolo from Ohio, I got to say, to hear him say that he's not necessarily committed to boosting Ohio's NAEP scores. Boy,
what?
This is a different
that.
Era that we are in. I can imagine.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, what does he care more about?
Well, you know, a broader look at, you know,
non-cognitive stuff, I'm guessing.
Yes, indeed. Come on, people. Both and. We can walk
That's
and chew
right.
gum.
We can.
Okay. Have all
well, I hope
these...
he's not listening to this part. I mean, he was kind enough to come on the show,
yeah,
and now
sure he is. Hello, Paolo. It's okay. He's a public official. He can take it. Oh my goodness! You know, we're gonna have all these people out there, these kids who are just have great grit. They can't read and
yes,
do math,
right?
But they persevere.
Let's hope not, right? Can we not swing that far? This pendulum stuff is nutso.
Yeah, I'm turning into checker here, Amber.
I know. I'm seeing it.
All right. What you got for us?
We got a new study that examines outcomes for first generation college students. It's going to make you even more grumpier, meaning those whose parents did not attend college at all. This was an IES report that looked at their entrance into post-secondary education, persistence, completion, and labor market outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Their progress is compared to two other groups. First, those students with at least one parent who earned a bachelor's degree, and then a second group whose parents had attended college, but neither one earned a degree. Okay. Data are drawn from three sources, not that people care a lot about this, but it was cool because they were drawing like these mm-hmm. longitudinal data sets from these huge samples. So Educational Longitudinal Study of 2002 tracks about 15,000 high school sophomores for over 10 years. Beginning Post-Secondary Students Longitudinal Study surveys about 17,000 beginning secondary students about their persistence and attainment. And then you got this Baccalaureate and Beyond Longitudinal Study, about 17,000 students, again, who completed a BS degree. So you've got like this, a really treasure trove of longitudinal data. Okay. Key findings: compared with high school graduates whose parents had a bachelor's degree, many fewer students whose parents did not enroll in college. I could have given you lots of numbers, but I chose not to. Yep. Took such high level courses as trigonometry, statistics, pre-calculus, calculus, or earned AP and IB credits. So in other words, you're already beginning to see differences between these kids who are going to be mm-hmm. these first generation kids in terms of what they're taking in high school.
Okay.
They're taking less rigorous stuff. Among high school sophomores in 2002, 72% of students whose parents had never attended college had enrolled in post-secondary education by 2012. That figure was 84% for peers whose parents had some college, and then it keeps going up, and 93% for those whose parents had earned a bachelor's degree. So you begin to see more and more folks enrolling in college based on what their parents did. Moreover, nearly half of students whose parents did not attend college first enrolled, what are you going to think? In a two-year community college, compared with 26% of students whose parents had earned a bachelor's degree. Next, we move on to college dropout data, specifically 3 years after first enrolling in college. More first-generation students who began college in 2003-04 had left without earning a credential, 33% to be exact. Compare that to their peers whose parents attended college. 26% of them had dropped out. And compare that to those students whose parents had earned a degree. We're going down, down, down. Just 14% of those kids had dropped out. I did not find this in the report, but a reporter covered this and I was scouring it. But anyway, her takeaway based on some maybe interview with the authors was that 36% of undergrads who began college in 2003-04 were these first-gen kids, and ultimately 4 years later, 20% of them had graduated. Okay? I didn't see that
20% anywhere. Of the 33 or...
Of the 36% of undergraduates. And it was a little hairy whether it was the same exact sample. But anyway, I put it in there and I thought, I didn't see that. But, you know, lots of times they interview the authors because they miss this big point, which is this one, which is how many kids ultimately were first generation. How many graduated? Like, they had this weird three-year persistence thing that nobody really cares about. We just want to know how many made it out.
But you're saying that 80% of the first generation college students failed to graduate from a four-year college.
According to
this reporter.
Okay.
But I looked in the report. I did not find that anywhere.
Okay.
So I'm
is it possible she meant that like 20% by percentage point of the 33 graduated? So
I wish, in other words, I wish I knew.
Like 66%?
I spent an hour today trying to figure out whether this was true or not.
Yeah.
And whether I was going to include it in my minute
not. Fair enough.
Anyway,
keep looking.
Last set of findings here. Among 07-08 bachelor's degree holders, there were no differences in the likelihood that they would be employed full-time 4 years later. So in other words, about 59% of all three groups, meaning those whose parents had not attended college, those whose parents had attended college, and those who had earned a bachelor's degree, were all employed full-time at similar percentages. Moreover, among these degree holders employed 4 years later, their median annual salaries were not statistically different between all of these different groups. So obviously, one point they make is these are early career salaries. We have no idea whether these salary trajectories diverge later in life between these first-gen students and their peers who come from more advantaged backgrounds.
Yeah, but this is huge. I mean, it does mean that if you can complete college, you make it into the middle class and you have closed the gap with more advantaged kids, at least in terms of income.
That's huge. Right. Yeah. One little last point, and it keeps going. In terms of those who enrolled in graduate degree programs, all those different groups, no differences among those who get the bachelor's degree and so on. So yeah, that's exactly the point. Like if you can just make it through, it really does seem like you've really made it in terms of closing some of that gap with your peers.
Hey, Amber, I want to go back to this point about course taking in high school because we just this week also got a big new data release from the Department of Education, the Office for Civil Rights. They had an analysis on STEM course taking, not surprisingly, shows big disparities by race. But what I'm curious about for this one is, were they able to look at the achievement levels of kids? I mean, did these kids take a test? In these samples? I thought some of these samples had assessments attached to them.
Yeah, I mean, this one in particular, they just looked at course taking, you know,
I mean, I'm curious how much of it is that, you know, fewer of the first gen kids were ready for those higher level courses versus they were ready and they didn't get access to it. I mean, we know from the College Board data that there's certainly plenty of low income kids out there who do very well on the PSAT and then never take an AP class.
Right.
Sometimes because they don't have AP classes in their high school or not very many. And so they're trying to close that gap. But
yeah,
I, you know, so in other words, how much of this is truly in sort of access gap and how much of it is a preparation gap. Right. And well, I feel like the press, I'm sorry, journalists, you guys kind of sweep this all together, you know, and I mean, sure, we can make sure every high school in the country has, you know, offers calculus, but you know, if there's no kids ready to succeed in calculus, then that's
just
kind of silly. But
ironically, I mean, remember our latest gifted education report, we found that both low and high poverty schools were more just as likely to offer gifted programs, which was kind of surprising because we thought we weren't going to see that. But I think that's right. It's the exact distinction that we need to be making relative to access and readiness. I mean, we've been talking about this for years, right? We put kids in courses where they're not prepared, and are you watering down the quality, and so on and so forth.
And actually, along those same lines, we have an intern that's reviewing a report or a study by the Education Trust in today's Gadfly that actually looks at sort of how challenging courses are in high versus low poverty schools, and they find that there's actually a huge gap that that high poverty schools tend to have significantly less challenging courses. So even if you sort of parity access, then there's also, I think, another question. Is the class you're trying to get in both schools, is it equally challenging in both schools also?
And they're looking at assignments there, Brandon, like classroom assignments?
Yes, like classroom assignments over a two-week period, I think.
No, I mean, I think it's all, these are all legitimate questions, and there's some limitations to what these large data sets can tell us. But still, like, these are important trends, right? I mean, I think in many ways, and I was looking, Raj Chetty's got another huge study out that I didn't look into that closely, but he's finding actually some opposite things that some of these, because after you follow them for a longer amount of time, that the salary things that I mentioned here, those trajectories begin to diverge more.
And then wealth, of course, diverges because inheritance and other things. But look, still, the argument for college is, to me, still very compelling if you complete. And the challenge is we're just still not where we need to be in terms of completion, especially for low-income kids. And so you say, would you be better off, you know, either just not completing a four-year degree or completing a two-year or technical degree? And I mean, that's where, you know, if some of these kids would be doing better if they completed a credential of one sort or another versus just leaving college with nada.
Because we're finding that most of these kids are leaving in the first year.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of it's finances, right? That's another thing that kind of gets brushed under the table sometimes. But yeah, sometimes it's just lack of preparedness.
They're not
prepared. But yeah, if they're leaving in the first year, could we get them through 2 years, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're not.
Or even a one-year technical credential in some fields are really valuable.
Yeah.
But again, the better ones, you have to have strong reading and math and writing skills. I mean, it doesn't make our K-12 job any easier.
That's right.
But it may mean that we need to do things differently, especially, look, in you know, 11th and 12th grades.
Multiple pathways, Mike.
So many. Pathways. Sing it. Sing it, Amber. All right. Hey, that is all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm Brandon Wright.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.